This is Veronica Entwistle saying welcome to Paradigm Shifters. Our paradigm shifter today is the second time you've been with us, Stuart Pearce, who uses the voice for a tool for consciousness, right? Is that what you'd say?
Absolutely. That's beautiful.
And also, you do some wonderful channels and work with angels, what you called the 12 orbs that came to you in 1987 or something. And I love what you have to say about the raucous turbulence on our planet right now that come through the angels. And anything else you'd like to talk about, Stuart, your big gift for us all today.
Well, thank you so much. How wonderful.
And happy Mother's Day.
and just happy Mother's Day to you as well. Yes. Okay. We can remember our own mothers who are now distant.
That's right.
In the sense of their spirits being off, way off in the constellations.
But they're still within us.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Stuart Pearce, and you are in London again. You were in LA for a while, weren't you, recently?
Well, I'm sort of equidistant, really, between LA and London, and I just happen to be here at the moment because of important meetings that I've been engaged in. But I will be in Los Angeles from May 26th all the way through to June the 8th.
Oh, okay.
And then in New York City, I will be at the Omega Institute for a wonderful retreat between the 9th and the 11th of June.
Well, it looks like it's a retreat with a lot of action to it, doesn't it? Isn't it?
Well, you know, the Omega Institute is so extraordinary. This will be my third time there.
Really?
Three very, very successful retreats. I mean, the one is Predestined, of course. I know it's going to be successful because I'm creating the thought form as we speak. There are already some very extraordinary people booked in, and they're absolutely wonderful at the Omega. So I don't know if you, have you ever been there?
No, I have not. I'd like to go, though, actually.
So it's a place of immense stillness, just outside Rhinebeck in upper New York State. But at the same time, the action that goes on there in the middle of the stillness is quite extraordinary. So we get this wonderful balance between the stillness of the center and the beautiful countryside of upper New York State, but also the action that goes on with all the people that come.
Hmm.
And they come from diverse backgrounds. You know, they come from all over the world to engage in the retreat. So hopefully we'll have a lovely group of people for the magnetic voice.
Yeah, talk about that. That sounds like a really interesting goal. Didn't you say you were going to help people find their own note?
Yeah, this particular thrust for this retreat is a development on the two prior retreats that we've held at the Omega. The first was an exploration of the alchemy of voice, which was the original Temple of Sound Healing that the angels gave me in 1987, which of course is now almost 30 years ago. And at the core of it is this substance that you've just shared of the fact that we each have a note, we each have a signature sound, which I believe is the song of our soul, and not often created by us willfully or consciously because of the socialization or educational processes that we've been through, which take us away from our note. And so that was the first one.
We're being vibrationally distracted, aren't we? Yeah.
We become vibrationally distracted, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The second retreat that I did last year was evoking the same promise, but concentrating more on the fact that when we find our note, we literally rest fully in the heart center.
Ah.
You know, and in fact, very interestingly, it was pointed out to me by a wonderful Indian guru that I worked with at the beginning of this century, that the heart chakra is called the anahata. And anahata in Sanskrit means the unstruck note.
Oh, so wow. Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? How touching.
Mm. So here I am allowing people to recognize that they have a note which is at the very core of their physical geometry, right at the very core of their hearts. And that when we produce this note, not only do our voices become harmonious, but because of the sound that we're producing through the use of breath, into our note and the resonances that are produced thereof, that we move the whole of our being into harmony. So if you like, our note is the Aristotelian golden mean. It's the point of finding absolute center within our beings.
And as well, wait a minute, doesn't that actually have a huge impact on the collective as well?
If we find our note.
Yes, if we're in harmony with ourselves, right?
If we can get it, if we become in harmony with ourselves, and then a group of us come together in equal harmony, what begins to happen is that we move from the diversity of separation into an extraordinary empathy. And so part of the work that we engage in as we find our individual notes is to come together in this synchrony and then produce through our own note, we produce a group or collective intention for whatever we decide on, which will be the healing of the planet.
Which would be respectful of individuality to a great degree simultaneously with the unity, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So it's always, there's always an absolute approving of the particular soul quest that we are all on as spiritual beings having a human experience. What's extraordinary, of course, is the fact that when we rest in the uniqueness of our own note and the possibility of how we shape our consciousness around the choices that we make physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, that when we start to share, there is a very unique empathic sharing where we begin to realize, oh, I think the same way as you. That's amazing. And as a result, because feeling is the language of the soul, not thinking, but feeling, we begin to feel the resonance of shared intention. And that's what's remarkable.
So this is really kind of like a quantum leap over how we group these days, how we amass, right? Have you had experiences? Can you tell us about experiences where people have like moved into community as a result or lived more in a community consciousness as a result? Or what kind of results have you had so far? Or is this cutting edge?
Well, it's leading edge stuff at the moment. And it's leading edge because really the thrust is to move us all into individual harmony so that we truly become the master mistresses of our own destiny. Once this will happen, I believe that the next stage is that we will come together in communions.
That makes so much sense, doesn't it?
Where there is a joint intention. And I mean, this is firmly an aspiration that I have for the work, that eventually we will be living in, I will be living with people that are like-minded and like-hearted in a communion where we're able to actually create vast fields of resonance to bring about whatever is necessary in terms of producing harmony around the planet. So, I mean, one of the greatest aspirations or super objectives that I have over the next 5 years is to bring a group of 33,000 people together in one of the Great Canyons in the United States with a joint intention, which is to bring peace and love to the world. And we will chant that into existence. So, yeah.
Ancient chants or what kind of chants do you use?
Oh, my goodness, where do we begin?
I just wondered if you had special ones or if it really mattered. Is it?
Well, the Om is something that I use very precisely because, after all, the Om is the calling card of God. So when we produce the Om as a sacred syllable, the resonance thereof has a huge effect on the entire physiology of our being. It brings all the organs into synchrony.
So to take it back to like the people watching this or listening to this program, if we just did our own chants, would we be setting up that individuation or that self-actualization? Would we be able to set ourselves up so that we could come in and join you at Omega or join a community ultimately? Can we start off at home?
Absolutely. And where I start off with most people is but just purely and simply by producing vowel sound through each of the eight basic chakra. I mean, we know that there are 12 chakra, but I work on the seven, the healing and the harmony of the seven basic chakra within the body, and then the eighth being the first transpersonal chakra and the chakra of the universal heart. It feels to me that, see, right at the very core of all the varying aspects that we're touching into within the possibility of sound as a transformative energy, that sound is the medicine of the future, and I would like to think that the future is right now. That as we tune our hearts through, for example, the most open vowel that we produce, which is R, it moves beyond any of the other preconceptions that we may have when we enter into chant, which may be, very simply, if we were chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, it may be that that's unusual for me, and therefore produces a reservation or an inhibition or a stricture that doesn't allow that person to open, because the mind becomes involved, you know, thought processes become involved.
Or long history.
So I start off with the vowel sounds and then see, well, what's going? But the Om and all the configurations around the Om is one of the most splendid, as is the great yogic chant Rama Da Sa Sa Se So Hung, which is absolutely beautiful. Rama Da Sa Sa Se Sung. And also the great Gayatri, Om Bur Burva Svaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bargo Devasya Dimahi Dio Yona Prachodaya. And when we're chanting all of this together, something very extraordinary happens. The Gayatri is considered to be the most sacred mantra of the Hindu and Buddhist faiths.
That's wonderful. I do that one a lot, actually. It takes me about 23 minutes when I'm off on a walk. But it's a wonderful gift that you're giving people to remind us that we can zero in on our old authenticity. We can, right?
Yes, it's quite extraordinary. It has a magical implication that as soon as we tune into our note, we automatically open up to slipstreams of energy that bring us right into the very fulcrum of us. They bring us right into, as you were just saying, the authenticity of our being. Because as we all know, that when we listen to someone using their voice, exploring whatever paradigms they're expressing, that we can hear if they are true or if they are not true.
That's right. We can. We already know that, don't we?
We know this, yes.
But I mean, do you think that we are all born with a note then? We are all born with a note? Don't mean to interrupt you, but...
Everything in the universe has a note, yeah. So we each have our own note. Isn't it extraordinary that we're 7.5 billion people living on this planet at the moment, and we each have our own note?
Preposterous. Unfathomable is probably an easier way to put it.
It's unfathomable, exactly. Yeah. It's conscionable, but it's unfathomable. And you see, you know, the interesting
kind of like fingerprints.
is that, yeah, exactly. That once we feel that level of authenticity, we move right into the very core sound of our soul or the song of our soul. So when you speak of the bio-identity of fingerprint, we know that sound is one of the unique blueprints to individuality, as the blueprint is, as the fingerprint is, as the eye retina is, as the DNA is. Sound is at the very core of creation.
So I have a question which might be disconnected, but I'm going, doesn't color always has sound? So some of it comes up in color. Oh, we talked about synesthesia last time, but I'm getting very conscious of that as you speak. Tell us how you got into discovering all this, or doing all this, or finding our access point to getting into this.
Well, I feel that the whole of life has been a form of remembering.
Okay.
And that the, you know, I had a birthday the other day, so I'm in my middle 60s.
Happy birthday.
And, you know, thank you. I'm a Taurus. And as we look, as we get older and we look back, you know, because I still feel 18, and then I look in the mirror and I get a great shock that, wow, what happened? And then we reflect on the years that have passed and see the pivotal points of the great milestones of great achievements or the renaissance that take place. It may be the end of a relationship or the end of a particular professional aspect in our lives,
right,
or buying property or moving locations. These milestones that we have, that we begin to realize that the thought clusters and the emotional behaviors that are around these milestones are in effect pure rememberings of something that we already knew.
So it's like, of course, when you have a certain drama, you come up with some knowledge that you might have forgotten that you owned. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are certain triggers that allow us to understand what the quintessence of our being is. Because I love my joys. I love my celebrations. I love my achievements. But I know full well that actually I've achieved most, I've learned most through the hardships, and not through
bless
the celebration.
Bless them, right?
Yeah. And so that's what I mean by triggers, you see. Mm-hmm. So they trigger us into a deeper quality of experience within the substance of our emotionality, within the substance of not what we think, but what we feel. I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said that when we pass, people don't remember us by what we said, but by the way that we made them feel.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah. So what you're saying is also evolutionary, isn't it? So going back in and discovering the essence of the being and taking these turns and so on, it's truly, on a big level, very evolutionary, even though it's an inner process of awakening, isn't it?
Yeah. So, well, it's at the very core of creation. So, I mean, for example, you mentioned color just now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that light is the purest and most powerful energy that we have. I mean, quantum physicists are saying that there's another level of energy beyond light, which is tachyonic energy. But at the moment, we haven't actually measured tachyonic energy,
right,
because most of the tachyonic energy arises out of a black hole. And we haven't sent instruments into a black hole, because when they are sent in, they would immediately dematerialize, because
right,
that's what a black hole. So we know that light is one of the most purest, is the purest energy that we have. But we also know that light, when it travels through the consciousness of our planet, that it downloads into color. And that we know that red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, ultraviolet into infrared, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, are the principal primary colors of the consciousness of the way that light interplays with weight, space, and time. And the other constituent parts, the carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen, and the nitrogen, the four building blocks of creation. So you see, there is light into color. But then what's interesting is that we realize that color is vibrating on different frequencies, and each of the frequencies have a sound.
Right, okay, right.
Mm-hmm. So light into color, into sound, actually formulates matter.
I
and
love
so
that.
Everything that is animate has a sound. So a tree has a sound, a leaf has a sound, the waters have a sound, the mountain has a sound, the earth has a sound. There is a note to Mother Earth, which, you know, if anybody's interested, they can easily just type it into a finding mechanism on YouTube, and wonderful recordings will come up of listening to the note Mother Earth, or the note of Jupiter, or the note of Saturn. You know, Plato said that each, you know, the movement of the spheres, that each the music of the spheres, that each planet had a note. And now we're beginning to discover through quantum physics, and that's absolutely true. And so I'm, you know, one's thinking moves into the field of cymatics, which is a Greek word based on wave ideology, that when certain fabrics or viscous liquids or oil are placed onto an iron sheet, and pitches that are frequencies are inserted into the iron sheet, the matter of the viscous liquid or the sand or the salt moves into organic patterns that are representations of the note frequency.
Wow, that's very brilliant, isn't it? That's something we should see. It's extraordinary. So were you born understanding a lot of things like the relationship between sound and color or your own note?
Yes, yes. And it was through the substance that you spoke of just now. It was through synesthesia. So I saw sound as a child. I didn't speak. It was all, the sensory overload was huge. So I didn't really speak for the first 5 or 6 years.
Really?
Which was very, very concerning for my caregivers and caretakers. But I had a brother who's a year older than I who interpreted for me. And then I began speaking. And I began to see sound as light through waves of energy. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't read before the age of 12 or 13 because I was so caught in the waves of energy, which was absolutely beautiful. In other words, I was completely consumed by the wonder and the awe of pure force, of pure light, and how light downloads into color and color into sound. I learned to read through singing.
Oh, wow. Did you sing when you didn't speak way back earlier? Did you?
I was always singing, meaning I was always sustaining tone through breath wave.
But not words, not just singing words.
Oh, yeah, sure. But, you know, the point is that I couldn't actually see a connection between the sonic glyph, which was the word in sound, and the printed matter. So, you know, it takes us into the science of the mind, but it's very remarkable how our ancient peoples did not read. And there are certain indigenous cultures still today that do not have a written language because they believe that when the word is written or when the sound is written, it's solidified, it's concretized in the moment, which stops it from being alive.
I really agree with that, although I'm always using words, so it's a little hypocrisy, I suppose.
Well, it takes us back to the origin of why we use the words that we use, and indeed, where do these words come from, how they tumble out of our consciousness. And there's a very famous Austrian philosopher, Wittgenstein, who said, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. Does it not for you?
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does. But so we spend our time struggling with that at times rather than getting into the core sound. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, and then we become liberated post-trauma, where we begin to develop a broader linguistic or a broader vocabulary to really identify what we've experienced. And so, for example, working with a client just yesterday here in London, a very, very dear person who is experiencing a tremendous amount of anxiety whenever she needed to leave her family. And so I said, this is called separation anxiety. And she said, wow, that's amazing. The two words that are naming identify the condition, which opened up a vista of landscape within her consciousness that made absolute sense.
Wow, isn't that wonderful?
Suddenly all of the trauma, all of the anxiety was named. And it seems that when we name things, that's when we start to have management of them. Notice I say management, not control. The fact that we can control things is a fixation of ours. We cannot control anything, but what we can do is manage. And when we manage, we stay in flow. When we control, we rigidify or fixate.
Right. So I was just thinking that the words you gave her have motion to them and color to them, and it gave her a field to play in, sort of thing, as opposed to a trap, eh? Isn't that amazing? Words are amazing, too.
Words as sound, I call them sound glyphs or sonic glyphs, you see.
Yeah.
But a word like separation in the English language is made up of what, three syllables, four syllables. But the actual, the symphony of those syllables, a syllable is a voice effort, that those syllables create this symphony which holds the consciousness of what we interpret separation to be. And it's certainly something that I could completely identify with on an empathic level, because it was certainly something that I experienced as a younger person, terrible separation anxiety, and investigated through Jungian therapy of what that meant. And it was very, very simply to do with the fact that there was a tremendous amount of social hurly-burly with significant people in my life when I was very young, leaving and arriving, but never explaining why they were arriving or why they were leaving. And so I felt completely unearthed or completely unanchored in that experience. And in fact,
did you feel abandoned or
abandonment issues were part of that.
And
yes.
Wrong? Did you feel wrong? Like there must be something wrong with you?
I mean, there was a whole, I mean, where do I begin? I mean, it's a whole plethora of different experiences coming out of not being grounded. And I resolved that feeling of separation anxiety through chant, but also living with the Bedouin. So I became a nomad. So I was literally living in a clan culture of 12, 13 people whose language I couldn't speak, because they were Arabic speakers, and I don't speak Arabic. Their eldest son was my master key. He spoke English. So he showed me the ways of his people. I dressed as a Bedouin and I lived as a Bedouin. No four-wheel drives, just camels and sheep.
Four-legged drives. Did you? How did you get into that? Like, how did you get to live with Bedouins? I think that would be a remarkable experience.
Well, at that time, this is many, 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 many years ago, but at that time I was having an intimate relationship, a significant relationship with someone who was Israeli. Who was by nature, a Jewish Israeli, who was by nature someone who'd experienced the diaspora, who'd experienced nomadism and seemed to move effortlessly from A to B. In a way that I never moved effortlessly from A to B. I was saw it as being a frightening prospect. I remember I was in Jerusalem and we were having brunch with friends, and one of the friends turned to me, a woman called Shoshana, who I liked enormously, and said, what's wrong, Stuart? You seem a little bit concerned. And I said, well, I'm leaving in 5 days' time, and so I'm feeling already very anxious about leaving. What? Oh, maybe you're experiencing separation anxiety. So that's when it was.
Doing. Yeah.
I said, oh, okay. So what do I do with that? So she said, well, you need to learn how to move effortlessly from point to point, geographically speaking, knowing full well that you're living in the now and that you're fully centered in each moment of now and not feeling any insecurity because you can feel your own security. And I said, well, what does that mean? She said, well, the word secure in Latin means self-cure.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. That's wonderful.
And so I said, wow, this is amazing. What do I want to know? I want to know more. And she said, go and live with the Bedouin. So I said, well, what? How do I do that?
How do
so
I do
said,
that?
Oh, don't worry. I know someone who knows a way of doing this for you. So I was introduced to the master key person who led me to the clan that I lived with in the Sinai.
Were you an adult then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was in my mid-20s, yeah.
So were they welcoming? Was it a delight for them to have
They were extraordinary. But, you know, Middle Eastern temperament is very different from Western temperament. Mm-hmm. So they were very still, but immensely appreciative of my entry point. And then they left me completely alone. But I became one of them. I mean, I served as they did. I wasn't just simply an appendage. Mm. I dressed as a Bedouin. I rode my own camel.
Wow.
I did what I needed to do.
What
I was
a wonderful experience.
The water carrier. And I looked after, I think we had about 40 sheep and goats mixed. So I was looking after one particular family of goats.
Did you like it?
I had an absolute ball. It was extraordinary.
How long were you there?
For 2 months. It was also very scary. But, you know, what it taught me is the fact that these people, these nomadic indigenous people, that when they travel, they rely purely on their instinct, purely on their intuition. So suddenly, for example, it could be day or night, they all knew it's time to go.
Ha! Wow. They're like birds in a flock, eh?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A murmuration, again, which, again, as we know, forms extraordinary geometric patterns. They all knew it's time to go. And I was saying, what's happening? What's happening? You know, rather like somebody saying, why is it so silent? You know, all the birds and the animals have left. And then the tsunami hits.
Right, that's right.
You know? And what I became aware of is that as we prepared to leave, which was immensely swift, that everybody had their own action. Everybody had their own activity. So, for example, the women would pack up the contents of the tents, go into boxes. The boxes were on the camels. The boys would go in and roll up the rugs. The rugs would go on the camels. The men would take the tents down. And within 15 or 20 minutes, the tents were all folded up on the camels and we were off.
Wow.
But while they did it, they prayed.
Is that brings in the frequency, doesn't it? So there is a unity.
It brought in the frequency. But actually what they were doing is giving thanks to Allah, may his name be praised, for all that they had received whilst being at the oasis that we were in, do you see?
Oh, wow.
So they were ritualizing departure by making sure that there was an expression of absolute gratitude for the abundance that we'd received. Wow. And then we were off.
Wow.
And then we would suddenly arrive. I mean, they would know. They would at night. They would read by the position of the moon or the position of the stars. By day, by the position of the sun. But they could read sand. I mean, one sand dune to me looked like another sand dune. But they knew exactly where they were. So they knew. They didn't use a map. They didn't use a compass. Well, they did, but it was an internal compass. But it wasn't. You know, it wasn't the compass that we normally use. They actually use their instinct in relationship or in harmony with nature to find their way. It was extraordinary. And then we would arrive and the same thing would happen, but in reverse. We knew we had arrived, so automatically the tents would go up, the rugs would be unfurled.
And everyone knew what their job was. Eh?
And then we would go in and we would drink coffee and we would say prayers to Allah. For safe passage and for arrival.
Wow.
So you see, arrivals and departures are, for them in sound, were absolutely ritualized. We never ritualize our departures and our arrivals. We just come and go.
That's a shame, isn't it?
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
And so you know, the Native American people would do the same thing. We remember when the Native American peoples were moved from their nomadic lives to reservation. And they would travel by the iron horses across the prairies so that they would arrive and sit in the stations where they would arrive. And the whites would come and say, what are you doing? And they would say, we're waiting for our souls to catch up.
Oh, wonderful, huh? Isn't that marvelous? And we've lost all that, Stuart. We've lost a lot of that.
Well, you know, I believe that what we're doing is that we're remembering the extraordinary nature of what we're describing, do you see? Because these thoughts that we're sharing touch very deep core feelings within us that open up vast vectors of energy. And, you know, here we are using this remarkable medium, but actually using our voices to communicate the truth of what this experience is all about. I find it fascinating, absolutely fascinating, that we're rediscovering ancient ways of being. So if we go back to sound and the magnetic voice, you know, one of the key things that took place 400 years ago to illustrate this point is that if a young man wanted to ask for a hand in marriage from his love, he would need to go to the father of this of his forthcoming bride to ask permission to marry the man's daughter.
Right.
And the man would actually listen to the sound of the boy's voice, the young man's voice, to register whether this was a being that had integrity. So the man would listen into sincerity within the sound of the young man to measure if he was capable of being true in marrying the young woman. Isn't that fascinating?
It's wonderful. Well, don't we do a certain amount of that when we meet people?
I believe that we do, you know, and I believe we're listening very acutely to some of the leaders that we have today and recognizing that they're not always in their note, that they're not always in the slipstream of sincerity that allows us to feel that they really are true and full of integrity and honesty.
I find it quite remarkable to think back on, for example, the Bhagavad Gita, which is, what, 8,000 years old and so on. And as we grow and we learn precious, precious inner tools, we're still living the same life of killing people, stealing from people, beating each other up. I'm like, wait a minute. Where is evolution going to happen in a collective way, you know? Like the attunement you have with the voice, and I want to talk more about singing and so on, but that, I think people have, a lot of people have some version of that, but it certainly isn't revered collectively, is it, enough to make it an effective evolutionary tool for our species yet?
Well, it has been. It's just that the consciousness was slightly purblind, because when you think about it, when we were children, we sang songs.
Always,
And we sang hymns. We sang hymns because, I mean, I'm making an assumption here, but I assume that you were brought up within the Christian faith.
Yes. Catholic, so, actually. Lots of chanting.
So lots and lots of hymn singing, lots of anthem singing, lots of chanting. It's just that we did it by rote. And what you and I are talking about now is that we're bringing a level of consciousness in where we recognize, oh, that was actually immensely significant. And we know this because although we may have different faith-making processes today, that when we come to a ritual like Christmas and we hear the carols being sung, we automatically join in.
Yeah, we know them, don't we?
So those song lines are still open within us.
Yes, I always remember this time we were singing in a place where the people had Alzheimer's. There was a fellow who hadn't spoken for 5 years. And after we sang the same songs over and over, because everybody was fine with that, he suddenly started singing harmony in this amazing voice, a man who didn't ever speak, lying flat in a wheelchair, and everybody cried, including me, because they'd known him for, you know, it was so wonderful. It's knowing it's in there, guys. So you need to, not you, but I think we should go in and sing to people who are so trapped in their, sing with people who are so trapped in their bodies, in their minds, eh?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, also your story reminds me of a video that I saw only a week ago on Facebook. A very beautiful man who is evidently the father of a newborn babe. This babe must have been only a week old. And he was holding the babe, and the babe began to cry. Dad reflected the same sound back at the child, and the child began to cry even more ecstatically. And so automatically, Dad just took a big breath in and chanted, "Oh," and the child immediately ceased crying and fell absolutely asleep.
Wow, I love that. It's a little like the Sufi one where if you sing your name over and over, and you've probably done that. I did that with the cat who's renowned for not ever talking to anybody, especially strangers, and I sang his name and he came over to me. He was like a pussycat and he just couldn't get enough. His mom was going, "Whoa," but it's the sound, eh? Also, do the Bedouins, this is a little sidebar, but do the Bedouins chant? They pray a lot, but do they
chant? they sing.
Most people have a chant, don't they, historically? Yeah.
They sing a lot. So we would sing extraordinary melodies. They were singing in Arabic, of course, which is a language that I don't necessarily speak well. But, you know, there were extraordinary melodies that had rhythm and cadence and profound melody totally within. Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you're mentioning cats. The cats we know have an extraordinary sound, and that's their purring.
That's right, yes.
And it's been proven that their purring actually has the ability to heal broken bones in their bodies.
In their own bodies. Wow. What about ours? I bet we had to lay it on a broken leg, eh?
No, we're not cats. We're humans.
Oh, we are.
So the frequency of catness is able to create harmony within catness.
That's great.
But at the same time, as you've just said, you know, that if you're singing the name of your cat responds. Have you ever purred?
No, I haven't learned how. Oh, I don't know if I can
try
do that.
Purring and see what happens.
I will, actually. That's a wonderful idea. So let's jump into the heart. A part of the video I saw, you were talking about the heart. I'm fascinated by the wisdom that comes from the heart. And I'm fascinated by, in our culture, it seems difficult for us. People say, oh, I always come from the heart. You know they don't, because they don't know how. You know, not because they're mean, but, you know, most of us have separated from that. I wondered two things. One is the Bedouins, do they live in that? Certain cultures do live from there with more ease. And also, you just had a lot to say when you were channeling with the angels about the wisdom of the heart. And I wondered if you wanted to talk about that.
Starting off with the remaining aspect of the story of the Bedouin, or indeed, over the last 50 odd years, I've spent a lot of time in Egypt. And over the last 12 years, I take retreats of people to Egypt. And one of the things that impressed me so extraordinary, there'll be another one. It's called the Resurrection Retreat, because we literally die to our old selves and are born to our divine blueprints by going into significant temples. And you see, the significant temples that we go into, firstly, our eyes reveal that they are in ruin. And then we begin to realize that actually, although our eyes are saying that they're in ruin, that the geometry of the building has a vibration that we feel.
It's very strong, right?
Deep within our bodies. And each temple is attuned to a different frequency and therefore has a different note, and is an astrogeographical geometry that holds force. So it's not just simply to do with this planet. It's also to do with what's happening throughout the universe, and indeed throughout the cosmos. And so each temple rather, is in harmony with a different planet, not just planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
However, we were talking about the people, and one of the things that I'm always aware of as I see indigenous people, and of course as we travel throughout Egypt, from temple to temple, we travel through small communities, often village communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an Islamic culture, as we know. So men are on the outside and women and children are on the inside. And we're not necessarily seeing what's happening within the interior of homes, but we see a lot of men sitting around doing nothing. Just being.
Together, though, a lot of times.
Being together. So they are together, but they're often not looking at one another.
Mm-hmm.
They're often not speaking with one another. Uh-huh. They're just being uh-huh. with one another. And, you know, the Western mind says this is shockingly idle. And then we begin to read their energy and we realize that there's a quality of stillness within their entire neurology that is very different from the Western mind, which is constantly boom, 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 boom. They have a level of stillness where they focus themselves and look straight at you. And as they look straight at you, you know that they are seeing your totality. They're reading your blueprint.
Wow, yeah.
And so with this level of interaction, we can always see exactly where truth and where falsehood lies.
Mm.
So that is very remarkable. And then we begin to realize that actually this quality of behavior leads one into the fact that if words arise from the heart, they enter the heart. If words arise from the tongue alone, they don't pass beyond the ears.
That's right.
And where Western mind tends to live is in this very, very high frequency, which is much more to do with this area of the body, the doing frenzy, and I'll stop doing it, of coming back down into the heart. And so ostensibly what I feel I've done is to illustrate that if words arise from the heart, they enter the heart. Mm. But if words arise from the tongue alone, they don't pass beyond the ears. And yet most of our culture is based on this very, very high frequency. I mean, if you listen to any bit of news reportage, you'll hear that people are stuck here.
I think it's also remarkable that this is a country of huge thyroid problems. And this is to me the synthesis point of squeezing the wisdom out. So it's another way of saying kind of what you're saying. It doesn't come up, right? It doesn't come up from the heart. It's people say, hello, how are you?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well, we're educated, socialized, and conditioned into exchange our diversity through debate and argumentativeness, where we constantly posit opinions. And it's purely and simply a social competition. Mm-hmm. To indicate, look how many books I've read, or look how many qualifications I have. But what I'm trying to do is to suppress the freedom in you by making myself look.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? That's an amazing.
Victorious. And we do it through here. And of course, as you and I know, that we were born into a sonic environment 40, 50, 60 years ago, which is very, very different from today. So, for example, one of the features that we hear so much today
is that nasality
yes.
thing? Yes, yeah.
Which, there's an American accent, which is a sort of cod general American accent. The same thing is happening in this city that I'm speaking from at the moment, London, which is a city that I've known for all my life, which is I'm in my mid-60s, so that's quite a long time to live. And what I'm hearing here is that more people are becoming nasal, and it's all going like that, isn't it? Mm. Which a lot of people say, well, that's Cockney. And it's not even Cockney. It's something that we're calling Estuary English.
Oh, wow, really?
It's all like that, yeah. When you go to the mouth of the Thames Estuary, when you go to the north, people that live in the north, which is called Essex, they tend to talk a bit like that, it's all like that. And then when you go to the south, the voices go all down there like that, I'm from Rochester, so what's that all about? And so the topography of the land and the way that we create our communities and the varying complex structures within those communities, whether it be to do with drawing in past tradition or past values in the swiftly moving changes that we're living today.
Fashion.
And through the fads that we choose.
Mm-hmm. And the Valley Girls. The Valley Girl talk is all over the world now.
So something has changed in attitude towards the excessive cerebralization of the way that we use our voices. And all of the work that I'm doing is taking us back into the recognition of the fact that, for example, one of the aspects of the retreat that I'm going to be doing at the Omega is introducing everybody to that, if they're professional communicators, if they're business people who need to present or make pitches, if they're teachers that are constantly using their voices, or if they're politicians, or if they're healers using their voices to communicate certain processes to clients or colleagues or customers, that there's a way of being able to draw the person in to the quality of conversation that one's having, so that the achievements of that conversation are always made very easily.
Hmm. It's interesting, because isn't it Isn't it healing for both the heart and ourselves to learn to use the voice in such a way as to move it through your body and actually present an idea? See what I'm trying to say? There's a healing component in becoming conscious of it.
Well, healing is a movement back to wholeness, isn't
okay.
it? That's what healing means. And what we're seeing through our conversation is that actually we're quite splintered.
Mm-hmm.
We're living in schism.
Mm-hmm.
And the big schism is the difference between the head and the body,
mm-hmm.
so that we tend to live up here as opposed to living in our bodies. And what we're saying is that one of the greatest healing processes that we can exact in our lives today is coming back into our bodies, and specifically coming back into the center or the locus of our bodies, which is our hearts.
Our hearts, yeah.
But the heart is the seat of the soul. This is not the seat of the soul.
Mm-mm.
You know, there was a long time that the extractions of Buddhism and Hinduism led us to believe that the vestigial third eye was the seat of the soul. But, you know, my conviction is that this is not so, that this is an extraordinary extension, an illuminating force, the all-seeing eye, of the way that our hearts are. And then when we go back into ancient civilizations, whether it be the Atlanteans or the Egyptians or the Sumerians, that what we begin to learn in Mesopotamia, and certainly in ancient Egypt, is that the heart was at the center of their belief in the substance of truth. So, for example, when you look at the ancient Egyptian rites of passage for someone who had died, the brain was ripped out and thrown away.
Ah.
But the other organs, the principal organs, meaning the kidneys, the liver, the lungs, etc., were placed into jars when the person was about to be mummified, so that those organs would be with them in their reincarnation. And the heart was taken into the most extraordinary ceremony, ritual, where we were taken by the great god Thoth to the halls of justice or the halls of judgment. And the goddess of truth, Maat, would take our heart and place it on a scales and weigh the heart against the weight of a feather.
Hmm.
And if your heart was heavier than the feather, a creature called Amut would come and gobble your heart up and you were dead forever.
Oh, my goodness.
But if the heart was lighter than the feather, the king god Osiris would come and take you into paradise. So they lived consciously their lives celebrating the integrity and the intelligence of the heart as the seat of the soul. Isn't that fascinating?
Oh, I think it's something to reinstall. What do you think? That's what you're doing in your work.
That's
and unfortunately, we have to end this, but I'm always really delighted to learn from you, to learn with you, whatever we're doing. You're very, very interesting, and you've brought some tremendous wisdom and possibility in through this conversation and your work.
Well, bless you.
Yeah.
It's been absolute fun.
It has been fun.
Well, what we're doing is we're creating a contemporary chronicle of the wonders of the human species and how we're waking up. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Stuart. And please let everyone know how to get hold of you and anything
yeah,
that you want.
Go to the website, www.stuartpearce.com, StewartPearce, and all the information is there.
Lots of nice videos and so on as well. Thank you, Stuart. Well, bless your heart, bless your heart, and bless your work, and thanks for helping us all. All right.
And namaste, namaste.
Namaste. Thank you.